Good morning. Well, good afternoon from Southeast Asia. I'm in the Philippines, everybody. It's great to be here. And a couple of comments before we go to our guest, Peter Ward. And they are, well, let's see. We've got so many here. Apparently, it's overloaded trying to look at my antenna. Just go to Google and put in W6OBB, and somehow or another, you'll get a picture of that antenna. It's pretty big. It's spread over 5 acres. And don't forget the photograph up there of the three gals. It is strange living in a house with three girls. And there was something else. Let's see. I'm trying to read through these very quickly. I get so... Oh, the kitty cats. Yeah, everybody's asking about the kitty cats. All three of my cats have once again come with me to the Philippines. They've now been around the world, I don't know, 1.5 times, something like that. 2 times around the world for cats. In fact, let me just lay this very interesting story on you. I guess it has something to do with priorities or something. But... fortunately, I have the money. When we came over here, we came on Korean Air, which I must say was a wonderful flight. Korean Air was excellent. And the three of us, human beings, were able to go for about $1,500, as I recall, about $1,500 tickets. Now, my three felines, Abby, Yeti, and Dolly, cost about $6,000. Now, at a rate like that, they should be getting, you know, caviar at every stop. They should be getting people personally tending to them and grooming them and petting them and massaging them. And I can't think of what else would justify a fee like that, but that's what it is. So having done it 3 times now, we're into about $18,000 of cat movage. They like it back here. All right. On to business. Peter Ward is professor of biology, a professor of earth and space sciences, and adjunct professor of astronomy at the University of Washington in Seattle. Listen to this. He is principal investigator of the University of Washington node of the NASA Astrobiology Institute. Here's the key, which involves the leadership of over 25 scientists studying the probability of finding life beyond Earth. He is also a senior counselor of the Paleontological Society and was awarded an affiliate professorship at the California Institute of Technology. And his topic this evening is going to be mass extinctions and the self-destructive nature of our planet, but I'm going to drag him off topic. Professor Ward, welcome to the program.
It is great to be back.
It's great to have you. I want to drag you, Professor, off I guess what we were going to talk about tonight. We'll get to that, but in view of what you've been studying, I do have a few questions, and you'd be perfect one to answer them, I guess. And that is, when you scientists have looked at the probability now, with all we know, and you know we're knowing more all the time, finding Earth-like planets, a lot of water out there, and I see the headlines all the time, this and that. But we're learning more. What is the probability of finding life outside of Earth?
Well, I think it's good, but the scary thing is, let's say we find life on Mars, which I think we will, is it Earth life that has gotten there by a meteorite, or are we Mars life that got here by a meteorite?
Right.
If it's exactly the same as ours, or is it even contamination, and so we're really going to be stuck?
Well, wouldn't there be certain ways of discerning if it was from Earth? In other words, wouldn't we find a match, or are we likely to find a match anyway? In other words, is life likely to be similar? I guess there is some underground volcanic action. There's certainly some water on Mars. All that would suggest at least microbial-level life, yes?
Yeah, you're exactly right. And actually, it's funny you say that. I lecture that in my classes. I say, look, is DNA could you make it many ways, or is there only one way to make it? So that if DNA is used, is it going to be exactly the same way every time because there's no other way to make it? And that's certainly a possibility.
Mm-hmm. Now, what about as we let's move away from Mars in our minds and go out to other Earth-like planets that are being discovered. I forgot. Tell you what, Professor Ward, think about that for a moment. I forgot my break. In a moment, Professor Ward will be right back. Professor Ward, all right, so as we go past Mars and we go way out there and begin to look at other Earth-type planets, I guess there are many, or we will discover many, then the probability of life, what do you think?
Well, let's just start out with beyond Mars. Let's go to Jupiter first and then Saturn. And we've got two really different alternatives for life. Jupiter, of course, you've got the moons. Europa has that ocean, 100-mile thick ocean, but it's capped by ice. And as we head out, the problem's cold. We cannot get bacteria to reproduce any colder than about minus 20 centigrade. But the great Carl Sagan years ago said, look, all that bacterium needs to do is integrate, put a little bit of ammonia in with this water, and you've got antifreeze, and it works great. So life, if it could figure out how to put antifreeze, would be fine out there.
But life doesn't have to be carbon-based, right?
No, and that brings me to, gosh, it's as if you pay me to do this. It's great. That brings me to Titan, which is so cold that it wouldn't be carbon-based. And there have been some really cool biochemical studies showing that it is a combination of carbon and, of course, silica. At very cold temperatures, silica unites with carbon to make very long chains that mimic organic molecules, carbon organic molecules, called silanes. And in one of my books called Life as We Don't Know It, I suggested that we skip Mars, skip Jupiter, go straight to Titan, because there would be cooler, better aliens there than any place.
Cooler, better aliens.
Plus, the atmosphere, you can land, you can parachute in, you could have airplanes on it. If the atmosphere is as thick as Earth's. Great.
Could you go, or would you go, boom?
You'd be dead really fast. But
your parachute doesn't care.
And you could also use hot air balloons. You could actually balloon all the way around there. This would be, you take your oxygen, get it out of the soil, and it's composed of pools of gasoline. I mean, you've got ethane on the surface. There's no problem for fuel there.
Well, all right. Let's talk about silenes. If it turned out to be silica-based life, what do you imagine it might be like?
Ah, there's a good question. Would it be glass-like because it's silica, or would it be prickly? I imagine still it might still look just like our common bacteria, that microbes seem to rule the Earth. Perhaps they rule outer space as well. But no one has yet done any sort of biomechanical analysis of what carbon silica life would be like. Fascinating question.
All right, so you could, I guess, whatever you could come up with in your imagination is a possibility, is equally possible, yes? In other words, anything?
No, I think there's still going to be laws, and there will still, everything's ruled by chemistry. Now, the question is, it's so cold, would that life, because chemical reactions are so slow in the cold, would that life be moving so slowly that we fast life wouldn't even know it's alive? I mean, you're talking about, do you see a big tree grow? Or, you know, maybe the trees are moving at different speeds than we are. And it's just that this could be like millennial life, with an atom moving here, an atom moving there over millennia. And we just would miss it entirely.
And it would miss us as well.
Absolutely.
Wow, that's fascinating. But if you get out, what about the big tomato here? What about the possibility of, as we understand it, intelligent life somewhere?
Well, that's the big hope, isn't it? Except that how much has SETI spent? 50 years of SETI work for nothing. I mean, at what point do you say, you know, maybe not? Well, it's at least maybe not in our corner of the galaxy, where at least they can pick up radio waves. But they will admit, even Seth Shostak, whom I know quite well, will admit that, you know, it isn't the 1 million estimate that Carl Sagan made. He suggested there may be a million civilizations in our galaxy, which means that anytime you go out and look into the night sky, you would see at least one, and we would be hearing them. That's not true.
Well, 50 years is long, but it's not that long. In other words, anything transmitted at the speed of light would only be 50 years out by now, or 50 light years out by now, and that's not that far.
That's true, but nevertheless, within 50 light years, we have many hundreds of other stars. Hundreds. And so we're talking enough numbers that it's just starting to get a little more significant. You're right. I mean, it's still early days, but it is not the earliest days. I mean, we're not in that first flush anymore.
In fact, I also know Seth rather well, and he said to me a show or two ago, which is quite a while now, that if they don't find life, I can't remember what he said, in the next X number of years, decades, whatever, that it might begin to be safe to say there is not life within, you know, a certain range. It simply isn't there, and they may be forced at some point to actually admit that. He did say that.
Yeah, I think the date I heard him say to me once was 2050. He said, if we don't get it by 2050, of course, that was 10 years ago. Maybe now it's 2060. You know, it might be one of those sliding scales. You never know. On and on.
And here's a good one for you. I wonder if you scientists, you said there were 25, I think, considering all this. I've talked to Seth about this a number of times, and I think there was one transmission by Arecibo, and we transmitted, I forget what it was, but years ago, one quick blast of a few seconds out there. And then the scientists began to get cautious, and they said, you know what, maybe it's not such a good idea to transmit out there and let everybody know where we are. It just might not be that great an idea because, and you can argue with this if you want, but somebody who would receive it would already be at a certain level of technological development. And in fact, the odds are pretty good if they're there that they're probably well beyond us. And therefore, if we advertise we're here, they might come get us.
Well, there's always that case. It's a case of, gee, are we going to meet the nice aliens? Or are we going to meet the nasty to-serve man aliens, that wonderful Outer Limits, I think, where they find us a cookbook at the end of the movie? Mm-hmm. Yeah, those are real problems. You know, there's a NASA official called the Planetary Protection Officer for Planet Earth.
No kidding.
That's really person. He used to be single, and he said it was the greatest pickup line at a bar in the world. He pulls out this card and says, I am Earth's Planetary Protection Officer. And he was serious about this. But it was his job to make sure that we don't get bad aliens on Earth, but mainly that we don't spread our aliens to Mars. It's that reverse contamination that they're mainly worried about. But, you know, we brought back pieces of a comet, Stardust. My good friend Don Brownlee was the principal investigator of the Stardust mission that got the comet in 99.
Right.
Mm-hmm. There was no planetary protection. They let that sucker float down in the desert in Utah. The Apollo stuff, they used to put those guys in quarantine, remember? Well, these pieces of comet, they just trucked it down to Texas. No planetary protection whatsoever. Any old virus could have been aboard that little deal.
Well, you know, the redo of Andromeda strain was in Utah.
I
just saw it recently, and it was in Utah. What a coincidence.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's where they land this stuff.
How smart or how dumb is that? I mean, to actually, a comet, after all, is, well, what did they determine? Water and little rocks and pebbles and junk?
People used to think there's absolutely no chance there could be life in the outer reaches of our solar system, out where the comets are, the Oort cloud. And then more and more people are starting to think, you know, any big rock with ice in it, there could be some liquid in there, especially when a comet comes closer to the sun. If you have liquid water and you have organic material, and comets are filled with organic material, why not? And so actually people are getting a little more concerned that, you know, it isn't a slam dunk. There's no life out there at all.
All right. Let me understand how great the danger really is, because after all, the Earth is plummeted by things that burn up in our atmosphere and sometimes don't burn up all the way and hit Earth, right?
That's correct.
So would it be true that something that passes through our atmosphere would heat to the degree that it would self-sterilize and we'd be protected against anything inside? Or is there a danger from things that collide with Earth on a regular basis?
There's quite a danger. There have been two sets of experiments. One was done by friends of mine at Caltech. There's a property of minerals where you lose your magnetic field, and it only comes when the rocks are heated up to about 100 degrees centigrade. They noticed that some rocks coming in, some impact rocks, still had their magnetic field, so they never heated to 100 centigrade. And to check it further, some scientists put actually some rock hunks on one of the heat shields of a returning Soviet spacecraft. And repeatedly, these hunks of rock that had bacteria put within them in their center had viable bacteria after coming through. So the rock outside heats, I mean, QED, there you go. It can be done.
Wow. So something like the Andromeda strain is entirely possible.
Entirely possible.
In the redo of the Andromeda strain, it was a kind of an intelligent a type of thing that was able to communicate with others like it, and it began eating up the Earth kind of like gray goo, if I recall correctly. Is something that horrible possible? Would it be so dissimilar to Earth that if it made it to Earth, it would be unstoppable? So, you know, kind of like the swine flu, they said, because we have no natural immunity to it.
Well, possibly, but, you know, there's a much greater danger from aliens than aliens from space. Craig Venter, who was the first person to get the human genome all figured out, he has a company down in San Diego, and he has, for the first time, built an alien. He has taken an Earth bacteria, changed the genome enough so it now has different amino acids than any Earth life. I mean, this is nothing that Mother Earth ever produced. This is the start. He is going to manipulate and produce a whole range of aliens on Earth. And there are certainly no protocols. There are no laws. There's nothing on the books to stop anybody from really starting a mess. I mean, it's Frankenstein myth, except really scary this time.
I was about to ask you, how smart is that?
I've been concerned. I actually raised questions. I was at a TED meeting, this really interesting group of people that get together once a year. I was the main speaker. Craig Venter was the speaker. And I asked him flat out, what about weaponization? And he said, oh, it's no problem, because my group could make a defense just as quickly as terrorists made an offense. And that's complete nonsense. I mean, yes, you can get the defense, but how many millions are dead first? That's crazy.
So, in other words, we now have the ability to manipulate genetic structure to the point where, you just said it, we can actually create alien, something so alien that it would be called an alien here on Earth.
Yes, we've already done it. It's done. It's being done as we speak right now.
That's really scary.
Yes.
Particularly if you're not aware of what the properties are going to be. Now, when he does that kind of genetic manipulation, is he sure, as he moves things around, that what he ends up with is going to be benign to human beings?
I have no idea if he's sure or not. I suspect he can't possibly be sure. I think it's very much similar to Monsanto, which began manipulating various types of crops and vegetables and that modified corn. They put in genes, for instance, that would make it impossible for corn to die from a herbicide, except the genes escape and they go to the weeds, and now you have herbicide resistant weeds, and same with the bugs.
I mean, I think it got butterflies or something, didn't it?
Yeah, it did. So genes jump, and in this particular case, if you produce some sort of strange alien that still has a gene that can infect a Earth creature, it's not far-fetched.
So before we ever see an alien from out there, we're going to be seeing them from right here, and they're just going to be every bit as alien as we might imagine anything from out there might be.
Well, certainly they'll be as alien as we can make them, and we can probably, technology can make some pretty weird stuff, and will.
Yeah, I really worry about the things we do. It goes back to the first hour story about CERN. You know, they're going to create these little black holes, and they were assuring us that nothing could happen. And now they're not so sure. Professor, stay right where you are. Professor Peter Ward is my guest. It's going to be a fascinating night. We're going to bring things back down to Earth here in a bit. From Southeast Asia, the Philippines, I'm Art Bell. We listen and we listen And we don't hear anybody saying, calling Earth, anybody out there, whatever. We don't hear it. We listen and listen, but we don't hear it. Now, here's something to consider. A professor can consider it during the break coming up, and that is perhaps advanced alien civilizations very easily would be able to get word to us if they wanted to. Perhaps they don't even use radio. Perhaps they don't use television. Perhaps they communicate with thought. I mean, if you can imagine it, it could easily be true. But the bottom line is, if they're really an advanced civilization well beyond us, whether or not they experimented with radio and television, if they don't want us to know they're there, we wouldn't know. And, you know, we have these sightings all the time. It seems almost irrefutable that something or another has been visiting us every now and then. But even there, you've got to consider, if they really didn't want us to see them, if they didn't want us to notice, we wouldn't notice. Well, of course, there'd be some sightings of, Venus and all the usual. But we wouldn't have these sightings like the one I had, you know, the big triangular object. Maybe it was U.S. government, but maybe not. So many sightings. Anyway, the bottom line question here is, if they're so advanced, and it's likely they would be, we wouldn't know they were there, not if they didn't want us to. We'll be right back. By the way, everybody, I said the photograph I've got up there of Aaron Uyaya, Annalyn, and Asia couldn't be blown up to be a little bigger. Well, I was wrong, and somebody corrected me on FastBlast. Thank you very much. The way you do it is just click on the picture on the front page. It will take you to a second, albeit small, photograph, and when you click on that one, it gets bigger. And you really can, you know, Asia's kind of small, so you can get a good look at her. All right, back now to Professor Ward. Professor, how about that? In other words, if a civilization was way ahead of us, and they didn't want us to know that they were around, there's no way we'd know, is there? If they weren't using what we regard as the way to communicate, transmitters, microwaves, something like that, if they weren't using that to communicate, then how would we know?
Well, there's certainly been progress, I've noticed, in invisibility. Even the military is saying that we're getting better and better at this. I mean, it began crudely with radar and radar deflection and the stealth weaponry, but we're getting better and better and better. On the other hand, there are limits of physics and chemistry that you just can't go around and get around. We are so sophisticated at tracking because we are paranoid, or societies are. We want to know if we're being looked at, hounded, examined, photographed by other Earthlings. And I would think it would be difficult to completely erase all presence. I don't know. I mean, this is pure speculation by both of us.
Well, it is. But I mean, what makes us think, except our own egos, that they would take the same path that we took in terms of, for example, television, radio, microwave, all the different ways of transmitting intelligence from one place to another, that they would even take that path? And if they didn't, how would we know? We wouldn't.
Yeah, but again, there's a sense that physics and chemistry are the same everywhere. And maybe that's even not right. But if you go through our galaxy, even if you go to faraway galaxies, it was the same Big Bang. We can see through telescopes and spectra, the same elements are out there. Therefore, you've got radio waves are radio waves. I mean, it isn't as if you could invent some entirely new way of transmitting energy and power and matter. So you are, I think, limited by the rules of the universe.
All right, let's try this. Let's stay on that path. Suppose they've got the same elements to work with. In another 200 or 300 years or 1,000 years, are we still going to be using fiber to get signals from here to there? Probably not. We're going to make all sorts of leaps. I mean, look at the last 100 years cosmologically is just a blink of an eye. So imagine, somebody thousands or even millions of years, and even that small, ahead of us.
Well, it's just the argument's the same one, Art, about Moore's Law, this idea that computers are going to double or triple every couple of years. You've got more and more and more. People have been noticing it's starting to slow down a little bit. And this is really one of the greatest of problems. And non-understanding. Are we going to hit a limit to say what we can make personal computers? Can we ever get to AI or not? Or will it just be going, keep going and going? You might say the same for technology. Will there just be changes that we can't even imagine? Or is it going to be framed more efficiently, perhaps with new materials, perhaps, but nevertheless around the same frameworks we have now?
I'm kind of hoping it slows down. I'm sick of buying computers.
I am too.
I'm one of those guys, I've got to always have the latest, right? And so something new comes out and I've got to make a change. I'm fed up with it. Anyway, it's hard to imagine, though, a race of people who might be that far ahead of us, millions of years. They would have certainly evolved past what we now know as any way to communicate. So if they didn't want us to know, we wouldn't know.
No, you're probably right. You're probably right, especially anything that is that far ahead of us.
Sure. I mean, you were speculating a little while ago about invisibility. We are just now sort of getting to that point where we can kind of make, aircraft invisible or very close to invisible. Another million years, and it's astounding to me. If you look at the last 100 years, it seems like we've had almost an eerie, disproportionate growth in technology, and it's hard to imagine what another 100 years will bring.
Well, just again, I hope you're right, but I was at a very interesting conference 2 weeks ago at Harvard called the Crossroads Conference, and some very interesting people were talking about the age of the universe, the age of our galaxy, and when it would be, after the Big Bang, that you could even have life at all. You'd have to go through a first generation of stars to get heavy elements. A star would have to go through its whole life, go supernova, before you could get iron or anything heavy. And someone said, you know, it isn't beyond the range of possibility that we are the first intelligence. We are the first to make it.
It's not out of the range of possibilities, but my gosh, with all of the planets out there they've already found that are Earth-like, and then when you project how many there might be, it seems improbable that we're the first and the perhaps even the only. Now, that's a frightening scenario to me, that we are the only. I don't know why it frightens me. Actually, why does it frighten me?
Well, here's some new information that has just blew me away. I wrote a book called Rare Earth. It wasn't unique Earth, but I've taken a lot of grief for people saying, no, there's aliens everywhere. Mm-hmm. But Don Brown and I looked at what it is that makes Earth Earth-like. So at another conference I was at, a Caltech guy named Dave Stevenson came up with a very simple thing. He said, what if there were no moon? Well, we already know that the moon keeps our axis at the same angle. We all knew that. But then he says, no, you're missing the point. If there are no moon, the daylight time and the night time, the revolution, the day on Earth would be 4 hours long, 2 hours light, 2 hours dark. We'd be spinning a four-hour day. The moon slows us down. The gravity of the moon on the oceans slows us to a 24-hour day. So all of a sudden now, what happens on a planet where you have a four-hour day? Now that brings some interesting conclusions.
And cuts into productivity. I don't know.
Well, it does a lot of things to weather. You're spinning so fast that the Coriolis effect is totally changed, as is the magnetic field. Magnetic field goes way up. Coriolis fold spins, and we start getting cloud banks like Jupiter. All those bands on Jupiter, it has a similarly fast spin. The climate as we know it would totally disappear. We would get big storm cells that sit over the same spot virtually forever. The heating from pole to equator would be radically different. It would be a totally different world. And so the question is, how many times do you get a moon like ours? And the answer is not very often.
What about multiple moons? I mean, there certainly are planets that have multiple moons, even close by.
Not big ones. They're just so weird that our moon is so large compared to the size. There's nothing else in the solar system anywhere near like it. Just a weird setup, and it's because we got hit by a Mars-sized planet early in solar system history, and that was a very improbable hit. And there it is.
Well, all right. But I'm not sure it makes the argument. In other words, from this point of view, and by the way, I guess I'm not scared that there's not life out. I'd be sad if there wasn't
sad
other life out there.
Too.
Sad is the right word. we sort of tend to sit here on Earth with what intelligence we have and say, look, everything is absolutely perfect, or we couldn't be here. I mean, like, for example, the moon and any number of other things I guess you could discuss. The moon's an important one, and all the elements we have, and it's just a miracle. It's amazing. But could it really be any other way, Professor? It has to be this way for us to be here as we are right now. So it's not perhaps as amazing as you think. It's how it has to be for us to be having this conversation right now.
Yeah, I don't know. That's called the anthropic principle. I've never bought that thing. I don't like that. I kind of just feel that we've won some cosmic lottery, but you know, somebody wins a lottery every single day in this country. It's rare, but it's not impossible.
It's Occam's razor, like, though. I mean, it's what it is.
Yeah, I don't know. It's just this whole sense that the universe was designed for life, that everything was put up so that life could evolve. I just intuitively, I don't like it. I don't know why. It makes us too important somehow.
I think it makes us too important if we imagine everything was just so lucky for us. And I tend to buy the other argument that everything is just as it is because that's the way it is and we wouldn't be here otherwise. But that's fine. We can agree to disagree on that. All right. Let's come back to Earth at least for a moment. I you know, it was irresistible not to ask you about life elsewhere because you've obviously done so much work in that area. It must be a fascinating area to work in. I mean, sit around with some other scientists and just, what do you guys do? Sort of kick around ideas about what might be, or how do you work?
Yeah, we do some of that. A lot of us drinking beer and just talking. Shooting the bull, you know. Sometimes we play ping pong. Yesterday I was up at a cabin mowing a lawn with a colleague of mine, and we're mowing the lawn and losing track of mowing the lawn, and we were thinking about hydrogen sulfide, of all things, which is a really interesting, scary gas. Someone in our shop has just proposed, and actually it was a dual thing with Harvard, that there is arsenic life, that you replace all the phosphorus in a cell and put arsenic in its place, and it's a totally viable life form.
Huh.
Chemically, it could work.
You know, you guys sitting around considering these things is one thing, but when you start telling me that there's somebody doing these things, actually creating aliens on Earth at whatever level, you know, tampering with DNA and producing aliens, that's really frightening.
Yeah, well, that is happening, and that's happening. But people with a lot bigger money than us are doing that sort of stuff. You need big money.
I'm sure you do, and you probably need a very, very good lab and all the rest of it, but we all know those things exist, and we can only hope they're being... I worry about science, Professor. I really do. I mean, whether it's CERN or whether it's somebody, as you point out, creating aliens or whatever it is they're doing, I seriously worry about science because it's going too fast. It's going faster than the politicians can make rules and laws, not that they'd probably be followed anyway, to control it. It's going to happen. There's nothing we can do to stop it. And when it comes down to that moment of should we push the button or not, the decision is always to push the damn button.
Yeah, it seems to be that's the case. All right. Well, I agree with you about the worrisome. I'm really worried about this, the ability to perturb life and change life and build new types of life that evolution ever produced is, to me, scary. And, you know, once we got atomic weapons, which is the analogous case, laws went up, secrecy went up, the government took it over, not always successfully. And the world, let's face it, produced very few nuclear physicists, people capable of building a bomb. Very few of those are produced every year. But the biological equivalent, the ability to perturb a cell and change it, that's available to almost any biology major if they put their mind to it. And we produce hundreds of thousands of those every year, millions around the world. And so you've got this Pandora's box that really could open.
And it only takes one mistake.
One mistake, exactly right.
So is there any way, I'm sure you've all thought about this, is there any way to reasonably control this, or am I right when I say there is no way, and that the scientists are always going to plow forward, they're always going to push the button?
Well, I was lucky enough to sit next to Craig Venter at this conference. I asked him exactly that same question, and he reassured me and the crowd that, oh, yes, those of us doing this have thought about protocols and we're very careful and on and on and on. I've heard that before, you know.
We all have.
It's just, you know, it's just, yeah, it, the chemicals will never escape, or yeah, there'll never be an accident in the nuclear power plant, and yeah, we would never lose our atomic bombs when they fly from North Dakota all the way to Florida without knowing, or yeah, we would never send the bomb timer all the way to Japan, as happened last year.
We have had assurances in every single one of those areas, and in every one of them, it's happened, including nuclear meltdowns and all the rest of it. So
exactly.
When you start talking about the creation of alien life, you know, forget the assurances. It's just going to happen, and I guess the answer is we can't do anything about it.
Well, at least we can talk about it, and here you and I are talking about it.
Right, but suppose there were some government regulation that required everything of this sort be run by what, run by a committee or something? I don't know. It wouldn't
be
workable, would it?
It would have to be a committee. But the opposite is even scarier. Again, I was at this conference at Harvard. Freeman Dyson was there, the great Freeman Dyson, the physicist. And he said he views the revolution coming at us, not so much the computer revolution anymore, but the biological revolution. And one of the examples he gave just floored me. He said, I expect that in 50 years from now, instead of giving kids video games, we will give them biological kits where they get to design their own life forms. But then he says, of course, we shouldn't let them have viruses. We'll tell the kids you can do anything except mess with viruses because that could hurt us. Look, I have a 12-year-old kid. If you told him not to touch the viruses, that's the first thing they'd go for.
Of course, yes.
It was frightening to hear this guy.
Speaking of viruses, I just have to run this by you at least. The H1N1 virus, there's some back chatter on the net. A couple of things about H1N1. One is that it was in fact designed by somebody and got out accidentally. And then the other is that Mexico is thinking that there has been some sort of morphing of the virus recently, some sort of change. Have you heard either one of these things?
Well, one of them, actually, yes, and it scared me. I had dinner tonight with two physician friends of mine, fans of your radio program, by the way. They never miss it. And we were talking about that virus, and my friend, their husband and wife set of physicians, he said what scared him about this, it reminded him of the World War One, that great Hong Kong flu, Asiatic flu that killed millions on Earth. It started out as a very benign or not very serious form, and then disappeared for 6 months, and then came back catastrophic.
Now, are you talking about an Asian virus, or are you talking about the 1918 Spanish flu?
The 1918, but he said that the analogy or the similarity between what happened then and what could happen now is what scared him. He thought that this reminded him of the first phase of that particular plague, which actually was quite benign, just like this one. Everybody thought the worst. It wasn't. 6 months later, it mutated in a slightly different form, far more dangerous than lethal, and then ravaged the world.
That's exactly right. In fact, the 1918 virus came in the spring, was really scary, then went away, sort of went away, just as this one is presently doing, and then came ravaging back between August and November. It killed millions and millions. It actually went around the Earth two or three times. And that was in an era when there weren't airplanes carrying it around the Earth. So so you've heard that rumor. Have you heard the one that says that it may have been something that was worked on in a lab and got away from them?
No, but then again, I'm already on record as being very worried about aliens being produced by people.
Yes.
And I guess I'd be the last person that I'm already concerning certain various groups for having the temerity to question some of this progress, if we call it progress.
Well, for a long time, I've been very concerned that it's not going to be the big things that get us. It's going to be little things, as in viruses and little tiny nanotechnological who knows what with many legs and probably a big jaw and lots of teeth. And anyway, listen, my guest is Professor Peter Ward, and we are going to drag things back to Earth and talk about our Earth and our climate and all of that sort of thing when we continue from Southeast Asia.